welcome one, welcome all. We're going to go straight into it. We're not going to be playing that last piece, My Foolish Heart. Sadly, no more blues. No blues. But we are going to start reading. We're going to get into more of the underworld from where we left off when we were on air. Actually, we're going to go a little further. So, this. Perfect. There we go. Reading height. That's what I'm hoping for. All right. So, we were discussing Carolina Rediva's the big map. Let's see. The Carta Marina. Ooh, we had some nice classical to go with this. Let's go find that again. Make sure to get some nice background music. Is it? Why don't you be infinite? Here we go. All right. We'll start from this one. Is it a good one? I think so. Yeah, that's a nice song. Something about the abyss in classical music really hits. Carolina Redvivia's doors opened, and I made my way into the entrance hall. Inside, there was a quiet grandeur, soaring ceilings and windows, catwalks linked by spiral staircases, crown moldings done in Swedish neoclassical style. The reading rooms were spacious and warmly lit, their shelves lined with hardcover volumes bound in muted colors. The effect was sophisticated, as though an art director had stopped by to organize the books. The Carta Marina is on permanent display in a rare manuscripts exhibit off to the side of the entrance. Sunshine is no friend to antique paper, so the room was as dark as a cave. Spotlights were trained on the individual pieces. Mozart's handwritten musical scores, first editions of Newton's Principia Mathematica, and Darwin's On the Origin of Species. Galileo's letters defending his theory of sunspots. I stopped for a moment to let my eyes adjust. Then, at the back of the room, I saw Magnus's monsters. Mounted in its frame and sheathed by protective glass, the Carta Marina takes up an entire wall. I'd seen reproductions of it, but I was still stunned by the intensity of its detail. The map is printed in black ink on thick ivory paper without any addition of color, and its lines are so finely rendered they seem to have been drawn with a pin. Everywhere you look, the map is buzzing with activity, but Magnus clearly wanted to make a point. On land, the action is orderly. Tiny figures are farming, hunting, skiing, playing the violin. By contrast, the ocean is in chaos, awash in dangers and tragedies, livid with waves and currents flowing, swirling, pooling, seething. Amid the tumult, 25 sea monsters make their appearance. At eye level near the Faroe Islands, and almost as big as them, a monster with a round face, a dagger-like dorsal fin, and spiky claws is frowning as it gobbles a seal. Magnus had labeled it the Xiphias. It has a ghastly head, like that of an owl, a very deep mouth, like some vast chasm, with which it terrifies and puts to flight anything that sees of a sore that sees it. Dreadful eyes, a sharply pointed beak, he exclaimed in his book. Beside it, another monster with a prominent snout and what looks like a bad case of acne is sinking its hooked teeth into the Xiphias's flanks. These creatures frequently approach northern coasts like sea robbers or ill-disposed visitors, and propose harm to all who cross their path. Magnus warned. Off the coast of Norway, a grizzled beast with a hump on its back grapples with a mutant lobster, while above them a hapless ship is being squeezed to splinters by the Sea Orm, one of Magnus's most daunting specters. This is a serpent of gigantic bulk, at least 200 feet long and 20 feet thick, he'd noted. And in case that doesn't sound awful enough, it has hairs 18 inches long hanging from its neck, sharp black scales, and flaming red eyes. Magnus stresses repeatedly that he's relaying eyewitness accounts, and that one of his sources and sent it to the Pope. The whole head of this creature, which is like very hard leather studded round with horns, is extremely heavy, perhaps because nature has so designed it for quicker submersion. Throughout his writings, Magnus comes across as meticulous, and his book is stuffed with citations to underpin his claims, so it's likely that the head of some large marine beast was delivered to the papal residence. On the other hand, Magnus also reported that in Iceland, the streams run with beer. I was standing so close to the map that I'd fogged the glass, so I stepped back and regarded it from a distance, only to be drawn right back in. Magnus's descriptions may be outlandish, but the Karta Marina is no cartoon. Its monsters were rooted in reality, and then subjected to an epic version of the telephone game during which they morphed into bigger, meaner, and more fantastical versions of themselves, until, finally, to a garbled, exaggerated story reached Magnus, who committed it to print. Paulus Orosius declares in his Life of Caligula that in the fifth year of his reign, a monster extending to a length of nearly 4 miles sprang from the sea's abyss. I think Paulus Orosius is telling some tall tales. That was for me. Many of Magnus's monsters resemble whales, albeit more diabolical looking, and it's obvious from its text that he was familiar with the animals. He knew they gave birth to live young, but there seems to have been some confusion about which creatures were whales and which were another breed of monster. Magnus believed, for instance, that the male narwhal, a shy, deep-diving Arctic whale with a protruding spiral tooth, was the unicorn fish, a sea monster with a huge horn on its forehead. With this, it can pierce and wreck oncoming ships and kill a large body of men. During his travels, Magnus would have met coastal villagers who'd encountered stranded whales and other denizens cast up from the deep, bloated and bedraggled and bitten, and, in all fairness, looking pretty sinister. What was a medieval farmer supposed to think when he stumbled across the body of a 50-foot sperm whale with its boxcar head full of 7-inch teeth? Without context or knowledge, there would have been horror. Magnus cited one onlooker's impression of a strange teeth, throats, and stupendously large genitals, the man reported. Attached to its palate were what looked like countless horny plates, hairy on one side, and no teeth, a fact which leads people to conclude that it was not a whale. Fear can take strange forms, so it's not surprising that our fear of the ocean abyss, a realm that Carl Jung compared to the madhouse of the subconscious mind, has produced some of the strangest forms of all. From the start, we've imagined the worst. In the absence of any personal experience with the deep, we've stocked it with apparitions from our mind's deepest corners, darkest corners. It's the oldest archetype in the human storybook. The monsters, the freaks, the others. Me. No. The beings we don't recognize, so we react to them by recoiling. Aristotle set out to demystify them. Pliny was determined to amplify. Genius was to get them all down on paper. It was hard for me to tear myself away from the Karta Marina, even though I'd been staring at it in the dark for 2 hours. What I loved most about the map was its exuberance. Even as he was adding horns, fangs, and scowling expressions to make his sea monsters look more fearsome, Magnus couldn't disguise his enthusiasm for them. Such great wonders have their position in the huge extent of ocean that even a person with surpassing talent can hardly describe them, he raved. It was that ageless mix of fear and fascination, that clash of attraction and repulsion. The biologist Edward O. Wilson summed it up in a sentence. Even the deadliest and most repugnant creatures bring an endowment of magic to the human mind. I left Carolina Rediviva, okay, with a handful of Carta Marina postcards, and a Carta Marina coffee mug, and the Carta Marina seared into memory, and I wished I could tell Magnus that his visions were still mesmerizing, almost 5 centuries later. For decades after Magnus's death, his monsters were copied extensively on other maps. But as seafaring became more common and colonies cropped up on foreign shores, it occurred to European monarchies that the ocean was something more than a den of trouble. It was a seemingly limitless place to make money. By the mid-17th century, drawings of horrible whale-like predators threatening ships were replaced by inmade images of ships engaged in whaling. Sperm whales no longer had tusks and blazing eyes. They had harpoons stuck in their backs. The monsters were gone, reduced to candle wax and lamp oil. The ocean still commanded respect, but our relationship with it was changing. To time travel through the 17th and 18th centuries and their seismic shifts in our understanding of the natural world, all I had to do was walk a few blocks around Uppsala. From Carolina Rediviva's front lawn, I could see the Gustavianum, a 400-year-old museum that's a quirky shrine to the Enlightenment. Among its collections are the version 1.0 tools of the scientific revolution. Microscopes and telescopes, medical instruments, Anders Celsius's first thermometer. There are barometers invented in 1643 and sextants 1731, and chronometers 1735. And beneath a domed roof on the top floor, the world's second oldest anatomical operating theater, a standing room only gallery where medical students and steel stomach citizens could watch surgeries performed on convicted murderers. If you were a budding natural scientist, 18th century Uppsala was a lively place to be. In 1728, there was a new arrival at the university, Carl Linnaeus. Aside from the fact that he was broke, damn, calling him out like that, Linnaeus wasn't your average student. At the university's botanical garden, right around the corner from the Gustavianum, he distinguished himself as a prodigy of plants. In childhood, he'd memorized in their Latin names, which at the time were long, baffling mouthfuls based on subjective descriptions. A cactus, for example, was the large melon thistle with 15 angles and broad recurved thorns, which are of a red color. And it was even more convoluted in Latin. Linnaeus became a professor of botany and medicine, and then vaulted into history by establishing the taxonomic system that is still used today to classify living things, a universal format that allows anyone, anywhere, to pinpoint where an organism belongs on the tree of life, and to identify its origin by genus and species. Over the years, taxonomy has been honed into ever more exact distinctions, and genomic sequencing has advanced the whole game. But thanks to Linnaeus, we know now the orca, for instance, as Ursinus orca, from the family Delphinidae in the suborder Odontocetae of the order Cetaceae, and not by Magnus's preferred name. The Grampus, or Pliny's description, an enormous mass of flesh with savage teeth. I don't know which one I prefer, the Grampus or an enormous mass of flesh with savage teeth. Both are really good. All of this represented a great leap forward, a sea change that shunted hearsay and wacky ramblings about monsters off to the side, and replaced them with cool, rational assessment. Although science was still entangled with religion, nasty battles with the church lay ahead, and the word scientist wouldn't even come into use until 1834, the post-Magnus era was a time of measuring, debating, questioning, and reasoning, of developing theories and proving them. It was a heady time of figuring things out. As the afternoon sun glinted through a scrim of clouds, I left what is now called the Linnaeus Garden, an assemblage of plants identified by its handwritten labels, and headed back into town to check out a Viking-themed pub where you could drink a horn of mead and eat roasted deer meat with your bare hands. As I passed the Uppsala Cathedral, I realized that I'd come full circle. When Linnaeus died in 1778, he was buried here, and his tombstone, set into the church's floor, marks the spot where Magnus's career was thwarted. The last Archbishop of Uppsala had never taken the helm in this cathedral, and ultimately it would be scientists armed with new technologies, not priests toting sketchbooks, who were destined to uncover the ocean's secrets. Magnus, as it seems, had been aware of his own limitations. In the depths of the sea, there are species of fish which never, or very rarely, reveal themselves to men's eyes, he wrote, sounding disappointed. The next wave of ocean investigators had no intention of waiting for those shadowy deep-sea lifeforms to reveal themselves. They wanted to hunt through the depths and find them. It wasn't enough to gawk at marvelous, monstrous creatures that had happened to expire on a beach. 19th-century naturalists wanted to collect specimens from their habitats, place them under a microscope, understand their life's histories, how they functioned, what they ate, and they wanted to conduct physical experiments that would answer some basic yet confounding questions. How deep was the ocean anyway? What was the seafloor made of? What were conditions like at the very bottom? Was it even possible to methodically examine a realm that existed entirely unknowable? There was no question that studying the deep would be vexingly difficult. Anyone hoping to pry knowledge from the ocean's underworld would need to spend months, even years at sea, eating hardtack biscuits and drinking lime juice to avoid scurvy, wedging themselves into tight bunks aboard ships that pitched and rolled and occasionally sank. They would have to endure cabin fever, tropical diseases, heavy weather, and everything else fate could dish out. Accidents and injuries were given. Deaths were to be expected. On his voyage aboard the HMS Beagle, Charles Darwin suffered through 5 years of seasickness. "It is no trifling evil which may be cured in a week," he advised. Darwin disliked maritime life for other reasons, too. He complained of the want of room, of seclusions, of rest, the jading feeling of constant hurry, the privation of small luxuries, the loss of domestic society and even of music. The ocean, he concluded, was a tedious waste. There was also the issue of equipment. Easy-to-use, reliable gear was non-existent. Soundings to gauge depths were taken regularly from ships, but devices were primitive and the method was inexact. Mariners would drop a weight attached to a long line, watch as it plummeted into the darkness, and try to detect when it hit the bottom. Then they would slowly recover it, marking the distance in fathoms, a unit of measurement based on the length of a man's outstretched arms, about 6 feet. Some sounding devices were designed to grab sediment samples when they touched down, but the only way to obtain a larger hunk of the seafloor and have any chance at catching animals was by dredging with an iron-jawed scoop or trawling with a weighted net, both of which also had to be lowered on a line from an unsteady ship in an environment that was constantly moving. These contraptions couldn't be maneuvered with any kind of finesse. They failed often. Lines got snagged and tangled and snapped. Their operations demanded hours of monotonous labor even in shallower waters. Working below 300 fathoms would be a back-breaking production for anyone masochistic enough to try. In its 1823 edition, the Encyclopaedia Britannica threw in the towel, declaring that, "Through want of instruments, the sea beyond a certain depth has been found unfathomable." It's an interesting root word. Fathom, the length measured with these deep-sea equipment. Unfathomable. You can't measure the depth of it. Unfathomable being, it's too deep. There's too much depth to be understood. But the story of a human ingenuity always demands a next chapter. And by the mid-19th century, there was a pressing reason to learn more about the seafloor, so we could lay telegraph cables across it. Once again, the Deep was commercially important. Sending messages by homing pigeon and packet ship wouldn't do in the age of electricity. Faster communications would also mean military advantage, not to mention bragging rights for any nation that managed to install a live electrical wire under 15,000 feet of salt wire. Saltwater. What followed was a decade-long technological experiment at the bottom of the Atlantic Ocean, as Great Britain and the United States collaborated and competed to run a 2,000-mile cable from Europe to America. Where to put it? How to secure it? What might gnaw through it in the depths? Would currents sweep it away? Expertise was urgently needed. As deep-sea research evolved from a pipe dream into a reality, the typical person who would light out on a seafloor surveying expedition was a European man, women need not apply, from a privileged background with a polished education, academic ambitions, and connections to similarly pedigreed men. The fledgling field of marine science was a gentleman's club, and unlike sailors, its members were not known for their high tolerance of misery. But the abyss was a wide open frontier, a bonanza of opportunity. Everything in the deep was new to science. Careers could be made on a single voyage. It was, in one naturalist's words, the only remaining region where there were endless novelties of extraordinary interest ready to the hand, which had the means of gathering them. Meanwhile, in nature-crazed Victorian England, people were enthralled by an aquatic discovery. Collecting seashells was considered a stylish hobby. Home aquariums, known as ocean gardens, were a status symbol among the upper classes. The wonders of the ocean floor do not reveal themselves to vulgar eyes, sniffed a how-to book for setting one up. Marine life transcended the ordinary, even when confided to a tank. Sea anemones were like rare exotic flowers, the book's author waxed, before injecting a darker note. Yet they are not flowers, but animals. Sea monsters whose seeming delicate petals seize the unconscious victim as he passes near the beautiful form, fatal to him as the crater of a volcano, in which he is soon engulfed by the closing tentacles. The last chapter was an impassioned pitch for a new form of entertainment. A titanic aquarium measuring hundreds of feet in depth, in which sharks would be exhibited in deadly conflict with human divers, armed with net and trident. In this go-go time of ocean enterprise, there were some notable ironies. For one thing, even as marine science was flourishing, sea monsters made a strong comeback. It seemed everybody had seen one, especially in Gloucester, Massachusetts. Where more than 100 people claimed to have watched a sea serpent capering in the town's harbor. Boaters and fishermen also encountered it offshore. Sightings were so frequent that the Linnaean Society of New England launched an official inquiry, taking sworn depositions. The creature was dark brown, snake-like, about 80 feet long and as thick as a barrel, witnesses agreed. It swam with an up-and-down motion like a caterpillar, and may or may not have had a stinger on its forehead. A naturalist by the fabulous name of Constantine Samuel Rafinus Schmaltz even proposed a Linnaean genus and species for the serpent, Megophius monstrosus. Great efforts will be made to take it dead or alive, vowed one local man, but the monstrosus evaded capture. No matter, though, because the deep was coughing up monsters everywhere. British mariners observed one with a giraffe's neck and terrifying teeth off the Cape of Good Hope, and a 50-footer that resembled a frog in the Malacca Strait, and a sleek beast with a bullet-shaped head near Sicily. There was a run of Scandinavian sightings that would have made Magnus proud. During my late passage from London, I saw no less than 3 sea serpents. A man named J. Cobin wrote in a journal called Annals of and Magazine of Natural History. The most impressive of them, he recalled, was at least 1,000 yards long, with a head that flared like a cobra's and glowing eyes. Reading his account, you have to wonder if someone spiked the sherry in Cobin's dress crossing. The monster swam with great rapidity and lashed the sea into foam, like breakers dashing over jagged rocks. The man insisted. The sun shone brightly upon him, and with a good glass I saw his overlapping scales open and shut, with every arch of his sinuous back, colored like the rainbow. Even some eminent scientists were believers. Their support was largely due to the unearthing of fossils, another Victorian sensation, from ancient marine creatures, including an ichthyosaur and two plesiosauruses found at an English seaside town. These finned dragons had once prowled the deep. Who could say that they weren't still down there? There is no a priori reason that I know of why snake-bodied reptiles from 50 feet long and upward should not disport themselves in our seas, as did those of the Cretaceous epoch, which geologically speaking is a mere yesterday, the British biologist Thomas Henry Huxley argued in defense of sea monsters. I can no longer doubt the existence of some large marine reptile allied to Ichthyosaurus and Plesiosaurus, yet unknown to naturalists. The Swiss zoologist and Harvard professor Louise Agassiz agreed. British paleontologist Richard Owen, the man who coined the word dinosaur, was a loud dissenting voice. The caesaurians of the secondary periods of geology have been replaced in the tertiary and actual seas by marine mammals, he countered testily, pointing to the utter absence of any recent monster remains. Owen dismissed the sightings. He was convinced the hysterical public had misidentified whales, sharks, eels, possibly even a gigantic seal. A larger body of evidence from eyewitnesses might be got together in proof of ghosts than of the sea serpent, he huffed. But the idea that the abyss harbored prehistoric creatures wouldn't be swept aside so easily. Owen himself had examined a chambered nautilus, a deep-dwelling ancestor of octopus and squid, and pronounced it the living and perhaps soul-living archetype of a tribe of organized beings whose fossilized remains testify their existence at a remote period in another order of things. With their striped spiral shells, button eyes, and mop of tentacles, nautiluses were Exhibit A, proof that a species from the age of the dinosaurs could survive to the present. The deep was such a strange lost world, so seemingly removed from the extinction events and evolutionary pressures that were known to have occurred on land, that it seemed logical for throwbacks akin to living fossils to be skulking down there. We just hadn't found them yet. I will be stopping there. You have been listening to Lazy Lazy on KDVS Davis 90.3 FM. I have been reading The Underworld by Susan Casey. If you so feel inclined, I will be on air tomorrow as well, 1 to 2 p.m., playing a music show. Thank you all for listening this past 2 hours. And again, this is Lazy Lazy signing off.
No importa su edad, ayude a sus hijos a desarrollar un hábito de leer durante toda su vida. Soy Teresa Montaño, vicepresidente de la Asociación de Maestros de California. Leyendo a sus hijos desde niños crea un hábito que puede durar toda su vida. Apoya la lectura en su casa. Lleva a los hijos a la biblioteca y dejan que escojan los libros sobre sus intereses. Leer es un hábito que puede encender una vida de aprendizaje.
Un mensaje de la California Teachers Association.
Here at KDVS, we're searching for a few public affairs hosts.
Imagine talking on air with underrepresented communities,
reviewing movies,
or even singing live karaoke. In case you're wondering, anyone is eligible.
And as you can tell, the possibilities are endless.
If you're interested, please email us at programming@kdvs.org.
Yar, here's some heartening news for you landlubbers. According to the American Dietetic Association, eating certain types of seafood twice a week may prevent heart disease, heart attacks, and cardiac arrest. That's because seafood contains a crucial dietary ingredient, omega-3 fatty acids. This follows years of studies suggesting omega-3s can help with heart issues such as breast cancer, strokes, and depression. Here, omega-3s are found in fish such as sardines, mackerel, and salmon. Here, here, here.
Hello, you're listening to KDVS Davis 90.3. This is KDVS Radio Theater. Tonight's audio play is a comedy spun out from the classic novel by Thomas Hardy, wrapped inside of a parody of our own past live shows. This is not an actual live show, but rather a comedy forged in the sweaty efforts of past fiascos and inspired by an undying love of ponderous Victorian classics. Tonight's pre-recorded cast is composed of Robert Evans, Stephanie Maud, Katie Sauber, Wince Hancock, Jeff Manager, William Nelson, Valerie Walker, Wince Paul, and Dane Fitzgerald. This play was written, directed, engineered, edited, and mixed by Les Light. This play is dedicated to ex-KDVSer Bashful Ben, father of Cliff Notes Theater, the dementedly condensed literary classics for busy undergraduates who don't have the time to do the required reading. Thank you, and thank you again, Dan.
Okay, we're getting the hypothetical, Terry. What if you just... Are all these channels working?
They were a bit sick,
Have we got enough microphones?
I just need to make one more. You want to hand me that soup can, wire, and electrical tape?
So how's the telephone hookup?
Fine. I'm running it through a processor and EQ, so it'll really fatten up the sound. It'll sound like it's right on mic in the studio.
Great. Can I hear it?
Sure.
Can somebody get on the phone just so I can hear on the headset if you could just...
Hi, hair director. Will we have a talkback system set up?
No, we don't have one. What is that? He sounds like he's on the phone.
He is on the phone.
Hey, do I have time to go to the bathroom?
He's not supposed to sound like.
I could put it through the Dolby filter.
No, God, no.
Do I?
Yes, hurry back, but don't get locked out.
Hey, do I really have to read this line? I'm a naya frau.
Yeah, it's in the dialect, and do it with the accent.
I think the modulation's still off on the left channel on the board.
I don't want to do this.
So do we have all the mics up?
I think
all the mic channels working. I can't do a live show.
Get a grip on yourself. Everything's going to be fine.
Oh, I found where that weird gerbil noise was coming from.
There, you see, he found where that weird gerbil noise was coming from.
Look at you. You're a nervous wreck already.
With the track lighting.
But the track lining is on. I don't hear any.
Oh, yeah.
I don't think we should do the accents.
We have to. It takes place in.